Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a week of notable deaths, the king of pop takes front and center. Michael Jackson died yesterday of heart failure in Los Angeles, ending a long career that broke new ground for music, for race, and for eccentricity. 13 Grammy Awards, dozens of top hits, accusations of child molestation. It was a life of enormous success and personal challenges. This hour, On Point, remembering Michael Jackson. Please join the conversation. Did you moonwalk at your senior prom? What's the Michael Jackson song that popped first into your mind when you heard the sad news? Joining me now from New York is Anthony DeCurtis, an old friend and a longtime contributing editor to Rolling Stone, author of In Other Words, Artists Talk About Life and Other Matters. Anthony, it's great to talk to you again.
A pleasure to speak to you.
And with us in the studio is Tim Riley, music critic and editor of the Riley Rock Index. His most recent book is Fever, How Rock Transformed Gender. Tim, welcome back to On Point, and thanks for sitting in with me.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Guys, I thought it would be interesting to kind of begin by walking through this extraordinary life. There are parts people remember, parts people grew up with, other people only knew the eccentric period. Do you agree that might be a good thing for us to do?
Sure. Yeah.
Certainly.
My earliest memories of Michael Jackson were roughly the same age. I was surprised to learn that he was 50.
Because in many ways he was only ever 13.
Well, and because he cultivated this boy child thing in his persona. But, you know, in 1971, when he was 11, he started having these amazingly vigorous and lively hit singles from Motown. And here comes this, the front man for the Jackson 5 out of Gary, Indiana. And, you know, everybody who saw the act responded instantly to a couple of things. One was, this is a lead singer with a backup group. This is barely a group, right? This was Michael Jackson's thing right from the get-go, and everyone knew he was going to have a huge career because he was so charismatic and so talented. And the other thing was, there was always a question mark hanging over him, which was, okay, he's a child star, so let's all cross our fingers that, you know, he can be as successful as he possibly can and keep the creativity levels high, but not get sucked into the celebrity, you know, michigas that seems to visit a lot of the child stars that pass through the system. And unfortunately, you know, Michael Jackson turned into like a towering example of what we wish would never happen to any of the child stars that come along.
Anthony, what were your first thoughts when you heard the news?
Well, I was pretty stunned. You know, I think like a lot of people, you know, Michael Jackson just seemed like a figure I'd been living with for so long in a variety of ways. I mean, certainly, you know, I remember all the early Jackson 5 hits. And, I mean, I have this great memory of you know, growing up in New York and looking out the window one evening when I was like 19 or something and watching these kids who used to hang out at the stoop across from the apartment that I lived in, kind of literally dancing up and down the steps, like while carrying one of these portable record players that was spinning I Want You Back, you know, and the Jackson 5 just were electrifying. And so when I heard the news, I was really, you know, I was kind of restored to a lot of those early, very vivid and exciting memories of who Michael Jackson was. And, you know, in a sense, it burned off a lot of the layers of, you know, the endless, you know, eccentricities and you know, scary scandals.
Yeah. Well, let's play a clip from that period of time. I remember learning to ski according to the rhythms of the Jackson 5. Then that was another little trick. And here's a clip from The Love You Save, a 1970 hit single by the Jackson 5 for the Motown label Tim was talking about, featuring Michael Jackson at just 11 years old. And it was number one on the Billboard Hot 100 for 2 weeks that summer. You know, I remember laughing and thinking, what is this little kid doing yelling out, darling, you know? And yet, made it work.
Right. Well, there's this very wonderful quality that he had as a child, which was he was able to sing these love songs and with lyrics about romance and, you know,
bands of
suggestive
gold.
Lyrics and everything. And yet he so transcended that contradiction. He obviously wasn't old enough to be having those feelings, and yet he conveyed something so simple and pure and true that it didn't bother you. It just boiled right off the top of the sound.
Yeah. There was also such a kind of wit and intelligence about Michael, even very early on. I mean, in that early Jackson 5 hit, you know, I'll Be There, which, you know, echoes in its title a Four Top song. In the middle of the song, Michael just goes, "Just look over your shoulder." And it's a, you know, it's a quote from a line in the Four Top song, you know, another great Motown band, and it was so smart. You know, there was just something that was so completely charming and appealing about him that, you know, it was very hard to recover, you know, years later when, you know, all the bad news happened.
So you guys are the experts, forgive me if I'm being ignorant here. Apart from teaming up with Quincy Jones, who was producing some of those hits that began to define the Jackson 5
Well,
sound?
One of the reasons for his early success was that he stepped right into the Motown machine, which was a very effective and by that point very polished hit-making machine. So he was surrounded by the very best people in the business who were coming up with material and helping with productions, and they also, you know, came up with all of the stage clothes and all the dance moves and everything. So he was very, very fortunate right away. He was able to just join this, you know, what was the analogy of an old-time movie studio, really. It was they had everything there ready to go, and they just hit some talent to it, and off it goes.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, as there was really nothing that was manufactured about Michael. I mean, you know, he was a very great student of Jackie Wilson, for example, and James Brown. And he studied those things, and you could watch, you know, there's the famous home movies that we've, you know, all seen many times, I'm sure, of Michael dancing, you know, in his family's basement, you know, in Gary, Indiana, you know, when he was probably not even in double digits yet, age-wise, but still knowing all those moves. And it was just somebody who was always gripped by this idea of performance. You know, he, in many ways, was a kind of epitome of that person who was kind of most alive when in motion and on stage.
Let's move up to 1984. Here's the hugely popular hit single Thriller. It's one of Michael Jackson's signature songs off the 1982 album Thriller, which, with over 100 million copies sold, is still considered the best-selling album of all time. And, of course, it was accompanied by a 14-minute music video with a cast of dancing zombies. You know, not only talking about what you were thinking at the moment of his death, but I was also watching the music video of Thriller last night, thinking this was just the beginning of the music video.
Right, right.
As you ever remember.
And it's a very interesting story because it's important in terms of the music industry on several levels. It is the first great, big, huge explosion of a black musician crossing over and capturing a huge, wide audience. And it was a very self-conscious angling of that music that Michael Jackson put together with Quincy Jones in order to do that. He wanted really to be as big as the Beatles, and he became bigger than the Beatles, and this will always be the signal moment in Michael Jackson's career. On another level, it also was a very defining moment for the music industry in terms of what you just said, the music videos. But what not many people know is that MTV really had to be prodded to play these Michael Jackson music videos because they perceived their audience to be largely white and suburban, and they didn't think they wanted to be watching black acts on MTV. And the record label had to threaten to pull all of their acts and all future Michael Jackson material from MTV in order to get them to play the videos. And once they did, there was that magical moment that happened. But it was really a very, and people don't think about segregation existing in the music industry in 1982, but that's really what happened.
Oh, that's really extraordinary. Did you know that he was going to redefine the music video, Anthony, when you saw that?
Well, you know, there was a sense, I mean, Michael Jackson always was kind of extremely visual artist. And I mean, it's important to remember that, you know, I mean, Thriller was doing just fine when it came out, but it was really his appearance on the Motown 25 special where he moonwalked that just kind of electrified the country. I mean, it was, I remember watching it and just leaping out of my seat when I saw it. And anybody who watched it, I think, had a similar experience. And suddenly Michael Jackson was just off the scale as far as, you know, what stardom could mean. And it was really, a live performance that did it, you know, on television.
Yeah.
And that element of incorporating that, you know, whether it was videos or, you know, who you are on stage, was something that, you know, was always a key part of who he is and, you know, just an essential part of his legacy and his impact on popular music.
Dancing, dancing, dancing. She's a dancing machine.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and we were just listening to Human Nature, one of the hits on Thriller by Michael Jackson. And we're talking about the loved one and the life in the spotlight, and you can join the conversation. Where does Michael Jackson rate for you among America's music greats? What do you want to tell a generation that perhaps only knows him from the trial, Neverland, and his Oxygen Chamber about his music and place at the top of the charts? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Anthony DeCurtis is with us. He's a Grammy Award-winning contributing editor to Rolling Stone. And music critic Tim Riley is also with us, editor of the Riley Rock Index. Let's take a call, guys, and get our listeners in on this conversation. Lisa is calling from Venice, Florida.
Hi, Jackie. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for being with us, Lisa.
Thank you. Well, I was born in 1980, and I'm from Chicago. I'm biracial. So, I mean, Michael Jackson has so many different meanings for me. Number one, in my most impressionable time, which is like, you know, ages up to 3 and 5, it was very popular. My brother listened to Michael Jackson. Everybody listened to Michael Jackson. Videos were all over the place. Kindergarten, we did Thriller and so on and so forth. So, I mean, that was, I have very fond memories of Michael Jackson. He also, in a way, helped me as a biracial person just because he did cross those boundaries as far as music-wise. It helped a lot because, believe it or not, in Chicago in, like, the early 80s, there was, there probably still is today. I don't live there now, but a lot of racism.
Well, and I believe it. I covered the 1983 campaign of Harold Washington, so that was a very, very seminal time. But it's interesting that it spoke to you in that way. Do you think that we're too hard on a man who never had bad things to say about others?
Okay. Yes, I do. That is one thing I have to say about Michael Jackson. I've never heard him speak an ill word about anyone. No one, not one person. And I don't think that it was something that he did to control his, you know, his media presence. I think it was just naturally who he was. And I feel very sad that he was treated the way he was by everyone because he was a commodity.
Okay. Thank you very much for that comment and thought, Lisa. Very provocative. Well, let's ask our critics. It didn't end the way that it promised to start out.
No, and there's something as unusual and surprising as it is, there's something apt, or how do you want to say, something that fits in with the whole aura that Michael Jackson projected, which is this weird, inexplicable death capping it all off. And we won't know the cause of death for a few days, but there are, you know, rampant rumors and talk from people inside his camp about prescription pills, and it would just be so sad to think that he had one of these ignoble deaths like Elvis Presley because of abuse of prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm. Anthony DeCurtis, well, a long, sad line, though, when it comes to musicians generally. I don't know if speculating on the cause of that death is really, though, as important as thinking about the isolation that really he seemed to
I mean, there are very few figures, I think, who could really even attempt to understand what Michael Jackson's life was like, you know? I think, and one of the reasons why he was, you know, sort of pals with, you know, this kind of odd collection of people, you know, like Brooke Shields and Elizabeth Taylor and, you know, Macaulay Culkin, is that they were all child stars. And I think, you know, I think he felt like they get it, you know? Mm-hmm. And there was an element, you know, when Michael was, you know, a young boy and he became essentially the family franchise and, you know, this superstar, you know, and as a performer seemed very, very adult. In an odd way, it's one of the, you know, the kind of ways things turned in his life, you know. As an adult, he seemed almost trapped in childhood, you know, he almost reversed that. And in the same way that he transcended race and transcended all these other kind of concerns, broke through so many barriers, you know, this desire on his part physically to become what finally looked like, you know, this kind of male, female, boy, man, black, white figure finally became almost unrecognizable to most people. So, you know, in a sense, it's like in so many lives, the things that were kind of really great about him also were the things that, you know, helped lead to his downfall.
Yeah. Let's take some more calls. Chinny is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Chinny, do you have comments for Tim Riley or Anthony DeCurtis?
Yes. Hi, Becky. Hi, Mr. DeCurtis. I'm calling from Acton, and I'm only 17 years old, and still Michael Jackson has had a huge influence on my life and my family. When I was growing up, my brothers and I would always listen to him and dance to him, and my little brother, who's only 13, still listens to him. And, like, this death was just a huge shock to us because we loved him so much. And the fact that we weren't even growing up in the time when he was really blatantly popular, like, we saw him on TV all the time, but we still did see him all the time. But this was past, and this was during the scandals and stuff, but we were still so much in love with his music and the messages he sent in them, the love, the greatness he heard, like, when he did that We Are the World special. Like, we saw that and we watched that and we were so happy. And like,
so the scandal really didn't touch the power of that message for you?
No, not really, because we knew that there was so much more to him than what the media wanted to rip out of him and turn him into. And we saw this as, like, almost like hope for our generation and generation to come, because we knew that that his music would live on, even though there was so much negativity around him, because I don't know. It's almost as though, like, his music made so much more of an impact than any other scandals that could possibly come up around him.
Okay.
And we knew that wouldn't even last. Like,
okay. Well, thank you, Chinny, and thanks for. And it's great to have a call from someone who's still in her teens on Michael Jackson. Let's take another call. Mana is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Mana.
Yes. Hi. Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to talk about it.
Yes, well, it's kind of a fan's day, isn't it?
I haven't slept since yesterday. I don't know if I'll be able to sleep for the next few days either. But you know what? I know he's in my heart. He's in everybody's heart. All his fans all over the world. Like I said, I'm originally from Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
It's so lovely to know that before corners of the world, he's recognized when you say that name, Michael. Or if you put on the music and whatever you're doing, you stand and take a breather and move some kind of movement, even if it's just the finger or the clutch moving or whatever. Doesn't matter how old you are. You want to do anything, you know, when you hear the sound. But it's lovely. It's so wonderful. And I hope people like me that are diehard fans and his families and friends have the strength to go past through this and appreciate. And it's unbelievable.
Okay.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
I think it was a lovely tribute, Mana. Thank you for sharing it with us. Here's another tribute from the Reverend Al Sharpton, civil rights leader. He told reporters outside of Harlem's Apollo Theater that Michael Jackson was a trailblazer.
Michael Jackson made culture accept a person of color way before Tiger Woods, way before Oprah Winfrey, way before Barack Obama.
Tim Riley, you brought a book into the studio today that maybe sort of steps off of the transcendence that Jackson had, Black and White, and as a cultural figure. And it's interesting for a critic to look at another critic's
well,
work.
It's one of the best. It's one of the best pieces of criticism that I've come across in the past several years. It's by Margot Jefferson, who's a very interesting, important New York Times critic. It's called On Michael Jackson, and I got it out last night, was rereading some passages of it because I admire it so much. And her thinking about Michael Jackson's persona, what he stood for, the culture he came out of, the ideas that his persona stands for, really, really very insightful criticism. If you're looking for a book that gives you a big picture of the whole idea of Michael Jackson, I can't recommend it highly enough.
Anthony, when you listen to these callers originally from Nigeria, 17 years old, what's going through your mind about, you know, you talked earlier, I really loved your phrase that at least today we're talking about the music's power to burn off some of the taint, if you will, of more recent times. But still, it's quite extraordinary.
Well, I think, you know, certainly that last caller, you know, you realize... Michael Jackson around the world is an icon, you know?
Mm-hmm.
All of these kind of, you know, things that we get so caught up in here. I mean, I think it's very important to remember, I mean, I'm sure we'll be talking about it later with the child molestation
charges.
Yes, we will. That, you know, that case was thrown out of court. I mean, he settled one. We know that there were problems there. But these were things that I think for many, many, many millions of people were just, you know, one part and a sad part of what his life was. But, you know, Michael Jackson was a very important symbol, you know, of an ability of a black man to, you know, achieve the absolute highest levels of commercial and artistic success. You know, culturally, it's hard to imagine. I mean, there's just a handful of people that you would even compare him to, at least in the world of popular music.
Yeah. Well, here's a comment that we found interesting from T.V. Reed, a professor of American Studies and English at Washington State University. He said the same thing. Michael Jackson was a boundary breaker.
Is he white? Is he black? Has he changed his racial identification over time? Is he an adult? Is he a child? He's a great artist, but he's also a schlocky pop star.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you have to be a schlocky to be a pop star. I think that begs the question. But it's interesting that he combines oxymorons in just every conceivable way.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to pick up on something that Sharpton said, which I think is really important, and because we have a black president now. And I think Michael Jackson achieving that fame... in 1982, that level of fame for a black person, which was unprecedented, is a very important precedent for the direction that this country has moved in since.
Please.
I mean, I just wanted to say, I mean, I don't know, has the president made a statement about this? Because I'm sure it would be a difficult thing, you know, given all the complexities of Michael's life, for him to really talk about in depth. But there's simply no question, as Tim suggested, that Michael Jackson was probably a hugely important figure to him.
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, you know, it's early moments yet, and we haven't had the funeral, and plenty of opportunity for the Obamas to say something, given that they recently had this jazz performance at the White House. I spend most of my time in D.C. It would not surprise me. I mean, really, we're not in the business, I guess, of speculating, but I think you both make a good point. The influence he had on youth, biracial culture, identity, and the Obamas' love of music, it seems a natural fit. Let's take a call from Michael. He's calling from Beaufort, North Carolina.
Hi. I want to say that I think he's a great artist, and I have loved some of his music through the years. Now, I'm 60. I think at this time it's also very important to be real about who he was. I think not doing that would be to dishonor him. And I listened to the 17-year-old, and she said it was the media, and she didn't take all the stuff that she heard about him and so on. My dears out there, it wasn't the media. It's a tragic case of someone who didn't know how to handle the fame, whether it was family or handlers. There are people who get messed up by fame and are great artists, and there are people who survive. It's a dangerous bargain, and you have to accept that whether it was he allowed the family to do it to him or he did it to himself, he destroyed himself, and it's a tragedy, and you have to take the great art and pay attention to the tragedy. That's my comment.
Okay. Because of that comment, I want to take one more, and then we'll talk about the fame machine. I mean, there's also a great power for entertainers to reach others. Mark is calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. And I hope I pronounced it right. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just, you were playing Human Nature earlier, and when I was a kid, my grandmother was fortunate enough to have tickets in a box to see Michael Jackson at Madison Square Garden, and I'm 39 now, so this is a long time ago, but he was singing Human Nature, and you know, there's a throng of people, you know, right at the base of the stage, and he looks at a young girl and he says, "Can I come down there and give you a kiss?" And he goes down, you know, takes a couple of steps down, and she meets him, and he gives her a kiss on the cheek, and she flat out just passes out.
Wow.
And so it's just like this, you know, almost evangelical, like, presence of, like, you know, to have that sort of almost spiritual level of, like, being able to have somebody pass out from a kiss, a peck on the cheek.
That is a fantastic memory, Mark. Thank you so much for sharing it. We've just got just over a minute in this segment, guys. But, you know, I was thinking fame and talking about not handling it well, but then we endow people with that kind of power, Anthony.
I don't think there's any way. I mean, you know, it's very, there's no question that Michael, you know, played a big role in his own downfall. I mean, that's clear for anybody to see. But, you know, I mean, really, very few people have walked in his particular shoes. You know, I think that, you know, it was a very odd world that he looked at as a superstar when he was, you know, 12 years old. And it totally spun him around. There's no question about that.
On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're remembering Michael Jackson. You can join the conversation. Would music videos be what they are today without Michael Jackson? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Anthony DeCurtis is with us. He's a longtime contributing editor to Rolling Stone. And Tim Riley is with us as well. He's editor of the Riley Rock Index and author of Fever, How Rock Transformed Gender. And I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now from Los Angeles is Jean Rosenbluth. She's a former music industry reporter for the LA Times and Billboard, and now a criminal law professor at the University of Southern California Law School. And she covered Michael Jackson as an entertainment reporter and later attended his child molestation trial. Jean, thanks for joining us. Well, you certainly span two parts of this man's life. And, you know, we've mainly been remembering his musical contributions, but we also did reflect on what many saw as his downfall, and that was this child molestation trial. Can you outline a bit of that for us, please?
Certainly. There had been rumors for many years that Michael Jackson had inappropriate relationships with children, and especially young boys, and there was, of course, the trial, the case that went to trial, but there were earlier allegations, at least one of which was settled by Mr. Jackson for some undisclosed amount of money. The case at trial was, you know, one of those classic sort of he said, she said things, except here it was he said, he said. And, you know, I think what's unfortunate in terms of Michael Jackson's legacy is that after he was acquitted, a number of the jurors said that they didn't think that he was innocent. They just didn't think that his guilt had been proved beyond a reasonable doubt. So this taint was going to follow Michael Jackson for as long as he lived. You know, and especially when you couple those allegations with the other bizarre behavior that he engaged in, and some of which people felt showed he was an unfit father, for instance, dangling one child out a window of a very tall building, you know, parading his children around with the strange costumes and the masks. So it was, you know, he, no matter how successful he would have managed to become again, and I think there are questions about whether this upcoming tour would have been successful on all levels, he was never going to completely escape that taint from those allegations.
Tim is...
Yeah, and the other reason that the acquittal didn't really absolve him from people's perceptions of him as somebody who had trouble in this area would have been that his lawyers weren't able to keep him shut up. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but he would go in front of microphones, and I saw clips again last night where he would say, no, no, it's the most natural thing in the world to sleep in a bed with a young boy, and this is what the world needs more of. And you just know his lawyers wished he had never kept on going on like that, you know? Mm-hmm. And
he gave an interview like that.
He just never was able to understand that to a vast majority of people, this was seen as something really kind of odd, unnatural, and really something where there really was a screw loose there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there was evidence at trial that he was not some naive sort of boy trapped in a man's body. There was evidence that, or testimony that he had an array of sex toys on his desk in his room, that he had been known to engage in, you know, body language and banter with other men. So you're absolutely right that when he gave those interviews, I think perhaps he was a bit naive in thinking that he could just sort of put out this image of being this sort of young man who wasn't really aware of all this sort of sex stuff, because there was certainly evidence that belied that.
Let's go to some music that precedes the trial. This is from 2001, or at least it's released by Epic Records in 2001. Two mixed reviews from critics. And this is the song Unbreakable, Michael Jackson's 10th and last studio album, from the 10th and last studio album, Invincible. Now, just in case you can't quite understand those lyrics, he's saying, you can't believe it, you can't conceive it, you can't touch me because I'm untouchable, and I know you hate it and you can't take it, you'll never break me because I'm unbreakable. You know, it sounds a little bit, Tim, we were talking about how much anger there might be in the Billie Jean song during the break. It sounds angry.
Yeah, well, this is another fascinating area of his sort of self-contradictory nature. I mean, Obama's gone to great lengths to talk about and to display how hard he's worked against the black angry stereotype. Michael Jackson actually is quite self-consciously angry in songs like Billie Jean and that song we just heard. There's no question about it, but it has absolutely zero political dimension. And it's completely non-threatening to white America, the anger that he's expressing. So it has to be some kind of deeply neurotic personal anger that we're dealing with here, because nobody feels threatened by it. I think it's extremely curious.
Let's take a call from Vanita. She's calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Hi there, Vanita.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to call and, first of all, to give my condolences to the family, but also to say that he is a person who went across generational lines. I am 53 years old, which means that I'm only like 3 years older than he is. And when I was a kid and he came out, we loved him. I came from a big family, just like he did, and we just thought it was wonderful. In the 80s, my son begged me for one of those pleather jackets, black and red, and I got one for him. And I found out that he passed away from my 10-year-old grandson. Hmm. And my 10-year-old grandson, if I were to ask him about anyone from any time, time in the 80s and the 70s, he doesn't know anybody except for the Beatles and Michael Jackson. And I just think that just says a lot about the type of music and how he affected everyone. And it was very sad for me to hear that, and that's just the only comment that I had.
Okay. Thank you, Vanita. Anthony DeCurtis, you know, when Vanita mentioned the Beatles and Michael Jackson, it reminded me again that he bought their list.
Yes. And, I mean, he bought it while in the process of, a close friendship and, artistic collaboration with Paul McCartney, who claims that he advised Michael Jackson to invest in song catalogs. I mean, as McCartney has done. I mean, McCartney owns the Buddy Holly catalog and many others. And he told Michael, now that you've got all this dough, that would be a good way for you to go. And, as McCartney sort of bickered with Yoko about, how much they were going to offer for the Beatles songs, which they did not own, Michael just kind of sneaked behind and, put some money on the table and got, what quite possibly is the most valuable song catalog in the world.
Yeah.
It's an interesting interesting piece that comes up when you look at his finances today, because I heard the number that he's still $300 million in debt. But, of course, the only leverage he has to get people to keep loaning him money is his interest in this song catalog that he still owns, that he owns jointly now with Sony and ATV. The song catalog is owned by a company called ATV, and so that Beatles song catalog is owned jointly now by Sony/ATV, and Michael Jackson is holding this many different notes from many different people who invested in him only because that was his leverage.
Well, it's too soon to sort out those kinds of complicated things, but there are going to be, of course, many complicated issues in his life from these last years. Let's take a call from Daniel. He's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Jackie. I think his death is, of course, sad and surprising, but it's also, I think, a very fortunate thing, because he was a middle-aged man who had a terrible middle age. It was, distorted, grotesque, painful for him, I'm sure, and by most accounts, kind of perverted, and he would have had an old age that would have been far weirder and sadder and more painful and bewildering for him. And I think he was a man, by many reports, that was taking Demerol every day for injection. So I don't think in his state of ill health he would have survived the rigors of a world tour and dancing around like a kid every night under, what drugs to allow him to do it. I think it's fascinating that he was still basically a boy in many ways, but he's 3 years older than Barack Obama. And in an age when we have a black American president, or a mixed-race president, if you will, making a pop deity out of Michael Jackson is a stranger thing than ever.
Hmm.
It reminds me of women going to prisons to try to wed murderers. It just seems bizarre to me that teenagers would adore him, but I guess they're just reacting to him as the eternal boy and the magical creature.
Well, Peter Pan, an interesting thought, and hundreds of millions of people would say that they don't agree with you. But I'd like to go back to Gene Rosenbluth. Gene, did you continue to follow him after this trial, and what did you think of the fact that he was going to make this comeback tour after living all this time abroad in Dubai and other places and the three
kids?
Well,
I think that he did the wisest thing he could do after that trial, which was simply to lay low. He left the country. He was out of the public eye for a number of years, and that's exactly what he needed to do. He needed to regroup and try to let the public forget some of this testimony and evidence that it had heard, because, as I think we all agree, even though he was acquitted, he was not, in the public eye at least, found to be innocent. So he laid low, and I think that was the smart thing to do. Now, for this, I don't know if you can call it a tour when all 50 shows were going to be in London, but these upcoming shows, I think, it did not bode well. I think, He clearly needed money, and so from the start, the impetus for him doing these tours was not entirely about the art and about the music. It was about getting some money, and there were already signs that things were not going as well as planned. I think the caller is right that some of these things that when he was younger seemed like like lovable eccentricities, you know, walking around with Bubbles the chimp and all of that stuff, when as you get older, it just becomes almost, perhaps this is too strong a word, but pathetic. And we had already heard reports, I don't know if they're true, that, you know, he was not showing up for rehearsals, some of the dates had to be changed, and so things just didn't look like they were going to go well, but we'll never know.
Scott is calling from Ashland, Massachusetts. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Jackie. I was telling your screener there, I was a career military officer, and when the Jackson 5 came in, I'd already seen the, you know, Buddy Holly and the Beatles, and the Jackson 5 was totally new. I was a Army major going to Rochester, New York, to see the Jackson 5 when I was 30 years old, and you know, when Thriller came back, I was back in the United States from a tour in Germany, and MTV was just starting out. I mean, I think Michael Jackson probably made MTV.
Could he have been a 60-year-old or a 70-year-old Michael Jackson, do you think?
Yeah, see, Daniel's point was kind of the one I was going to make. I mean, I was thinking about this when I heard the announcement, and I thought, you know, of course. I mean, how else could it end for this dude? I mean, to see him, I mean, I'm pushing 70, and this to see this guy as a 70-year-old would have been pretty amazing, you know. I mean, I got to say that, you know, after all these kind of, they call them eccentricities, but I found it kind of creepy, you know. I mean, the guy was 40, 45, you know, now 50, and his whole life style was kind of just creepy,
disturbing,
you know?
To you.
I couldn't get into his music at all.
Okay. Well, thank you, Scott. I mean, Anthony DeCurtis, you know, it's so interesting, though. I mean, I don't think anyone would deny Michael Jackson the chance to try for the rest of his life.
I mean, it's a little stunning for me to hear, you know, him spoken about with such tremendous condescension. I mean, he's among the handful of greatest performers who ever lived. So I'd go see that show, you know, and we'll see how it went. You know, there were, you know, questions that you could wonder about. He sold out 50 shows in London. You know, there was a high level of interest. Those people weren't all music critics, you know. So I don't think it's impossible. You know, I don't know that he could have turned his career around. I mean, there really was a tremendous amount of, you know, I mean, suspicion of him. And really, you know, there was a creepy aspect to him. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, without question, you know, if a Michael Jackson record came out or if Michael, you know, went on a world tour, it would be a very big deal.
And not to be able to have that, you know, we really imagine what feels like such an oceanic loss because appearances are not appearances. We would have expected a lot more music.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, he was trying, you know, you know, you could take anybody's death. You know, it'd be possible to say, you know, Kurt Cobain, he was such a rebel, you know. It was a good thing he died when he was 27 because, you know, he really would never have, you know, that 60-year-old reunion tour just wouldn't have suited him. And it's like, well, you know, let's give him a chance. And, you know, I mean, I sort of feel similarly about Michael Jackson. I mean, as I said, I would have happily gone to one of those shows in London.
Would you have gone to?
Oh, absolutely. And I saw the show, the Thriller shows in 1984, and I went as a critic and not as too much of a fan. And I was really impressed. The guy was lightning in a bottle. He was on stage. He was electrifying. So I agree with that. I think 50 is way too young for anybody to die.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what I am left with is thinking that we have had on this show a woman born in Nigeria, someone in the military, people from all walks of life, and he seems as close as your own heart, and that's what continues to beat, to thrill, to charm, and I think, you know, the strongest memory, certainly for me. I want to thank everybody for being here. Jean Rosenbluth is a professor of law at the University of Southern California. Jean, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Anthony DeCurtis is contributing editor to Rolling Stone. It was great to talk to you again, Anthony.
Yes, thank you so much.
And Tim Riley, editor of the Riley Rock Index, thanks for coming in and joining us.
Nice to be here.
And you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast on our website. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. Remembering Michael Jackson, this is On Point.